Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Southern Utah Science Cafe. My name is Brady Iverson, and I'm here with Dr. Joan Miners, local bee biologist and journalist. Dr. Miners, tell us a bit about yourself.
Yes, I have a past as a bee scientist, did my PhD on studying native bees at the University of Florida, and I am now an environment reporter at the local paper, the Spectrum and Daily News in St. George. So I was a bee biologist, transitioned into a journalist over the last few years. And so, I learned a lot of things about bees, and then now I don't talk about bees very much anymore, but I'm excited to do that today.
How did you get so into bees in the first place?
I mean, I was like a tree climbing, dirt digging child, leaf collecting, you know, rugrat, and collected a lot of insects and bees and like to, you know, kind of pull them apart and see how they were put together after they're dead, of course. You know, not like psychopath stuff, but, you know, just looking at how bees are all put together, you know, when you find them on the ground dead. And then I actually ended up doing my eighth grade science fair project on bees after I wrote a paper on bees. And so there's a little bit of a thread there of a lifelong interest in bees. And so I pursued that all the way through a master's degree and a PhD. And so I guess you could kind of say that my passion for bees led me very far down the academic path. And then, you know, I kind of got to the end of that path and realized, you know, I do love bees, but I didn't want to do this as a job. So then I shifted kind of into journalism.
So did you ever stray into other entomology, or was it mostly just the love for bees purely all the way through?
I mean, my degree is in ecology, not entomology. So I don't refer to myself as an entomologist. I do have a box of pinned insects in my freezer. So maybe other people would think that that qualifies you as
Me
a general
too.
Entomologist.
I've got a box too.
Awesome.
I've got jars.
Okay. Nice.
Okay. So I was hoping we could just go through like a cast of local characters, local pollinators, bees.
Yeah. Do you know how many species there are
in
the world?
I read it this week.
I like having people guess.
It's like thousands, right? Like
there's somewhere between 20 and 30,000 species of bees in the world. Probably a lot yet to be described that are really rare and only occur in very localized little patches of habitat. A lot of them are really tiny, so there's a lot yet to be known about bees, but there are at least 20,000 described species across the world.
Wow.
So many, many to talk about.
Do you have any favorites that live in our local area, the Mojave Desert, St. George, Southern Utah area?
So most of the research I did was in California, mm-hmm. And there's some overlap with the bees there and the bees here. One of my favorite is a species called Diadasia rinconis. I have actually a tattoo of it on my arm, which you can't see because I'm wearing long sleeves, but I like that one. It's very cute and fuzzy.
Does he have a common name, or is she?
It's a cactus bee, but you know, it's a cactus specialist. Most of these 20—I mean, nobody bothered to name 20,000 different species of bees in the world, so most of them don't have common names. So we do talk in Latin most of the time when we're talking about native bee biology. But that one is a cactus specialist. Only visits cactus in obviously dry desert areas. And it's just really cute and fuzzy, and it's rare, so it was kind of a fun find for me.
So, Brady, Utah is the beehive state. Why is that?
Well, apparently the early pioneers recognized the bee as a master of industry as far as the insect world goes, and that is the state slogan. I don't know which came first.
Yeah, the state motto is industry, and European honeybees are really industrious. Utah is not alone in having the European honeybee as their state insect, though.
No, in fact, something like 19 states features the European honeybee as a state insect.
Yeah, but there are also a lot of weird made-up categories. Alabama, for instance, has the queen European honeybee, so just like one individual, I guess, as the state agricultural insect. It's not the state insect because that's the monarch butterfly. The monarch butterfly is not the state butterfly. In Alabama, that's the eastern tiger swallowtail. So that's kind of made up and a little bit confusing and probably doesn't have a whole lot of bearing on the diversity of insects in that state. How does Utah hold up in terms of bee diversity compared to other states?
Well, Stephen Stanko, an entomologist from the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food, said that Utah is home to more than 1,200 species. And in fact, the southern half of Utah has as many native species as the entire eastern half of North America, east of the Mississippi.
Yeah, Utah is number one in terms of bee diversity in all of the United States. And 1,200 is kind of a large number. I have seen at least 900 named, described species of bees, and at least 660 in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument alone. And there are clearly more than that. They just haven't been discovered yet. There was a newly described sandstone drilling bee that was described just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, called Anthophora Pueblo, named after the Pueblo Native Americans who also carved their cities and homes into the sides of the sandstone. It comes with pros and cons. It wears down mandibles, but it provides a lot more safety for their young, and they get to reuse their homes each year instead of having to bore a new one out of a new rotting log every season.
Yeah, they can kind of even be a form of generational wealth, I guess, because other bees can use burrows that are decades old, much older than the bees themselves can get. They also have to nest near water because they kind of need to bring water to the sandstone to dig in. So let's get back to Dr. Miners.
When I started grad school, they sent me right out into the field. I didn't really have any coursework ahead of time. So the first thing I did as a new grad student was get shipped off to California, where I was handed a bee net and told to like go discover the bee biodiversity of this national park in California. And I did not know very much about native bees yet. I mean, I had this background of being interested in bees as a kid, but I didn't know specific species, and they all kind of just looked the same while they were flying by really fast, and I was trying to catch them and failing and practicing, you know. So I started coming up with all these names for them during my first field season, where I was like, that's the crazy-eyed bee, and that's the, you know, the mohawk bee, and that's the Morse code bee. There's a bee, Anthidium, that, you know, now I know the Latin names, but at the time I didn't, so I called it the Morse code bee because it has kind of like a dash, dot, dot, dash pattern on its abdomen. So things like that. Sometimes it's more fun to describe the bees in those terms than in Latin names that don't mean anything to anyone.
So that's a perfect segue, actually. I was kind of very interested in your work in Pinnacles National Park. Why is that place such a bee hotspot? Like why are there so many types of local pollinators, or so much variety, I mean?
Yeah, so one of my chapters for my dissertation is trying to answer that exact question. And what we concluded was, so first of all, there are 450 species of bees in Pinnacles National Park, which is pretty small. It's really 6 by 6 miles kind of area. You can walk across the whole thing in a day. And so it's astonishing that there are that many species of bees all cohabiting in that area. And the reason that I spent 2 years going to all different types of habitats across the park and sampling the bees that were there and recording data about the habitats themselves to try to tease apart kind of which ones are the most important for bee biodiversity. And actually it's a very kind of mosaic habitat where there's a lot of different types of vegetation and soil types and wildflower compositions that all kind of alternate in these like patches, because there's an elevational gradient. So you have to hike from the west to the east side. You go up and over this big ridge that you know, gives you some elevational differences and some different flower species because of that. It's also on a couple fault lines, Pinnacles is. So the idea there is that, you know, some of these plates shifted over time and brought together kind of different soil types that then more different soil types than might exist in an area where, you know, the ground, the plates weren't shifting into, you know, against each other at that spot. So, and it's right at the, it's kind of right at the transition zone from Northern California flora to Southern California flora. So basically there's just a whole lot going on with the plants and soil. And so then there's a whole lot going on with the bees.
That makes sense. Just a lot of diversity in general everywhere. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about.
Yep.
Did I read that you guys discovered 48 new species on that, in that project?
Yeah.
How do you even decide it is a new species? Like, what's that process like? That must, it sounds so arduous.
Yes, and that is not my area. So I worked in a lab that is focused on systematics, which is, you know, kind of the fancy word for what we all think of as taxonomy, where systematics is, you know, they're, the systematists are the ones who decide when a new species is a new species or when two species that were previously different species need to be lumped into one species because that person who separated them was wrong. And so it's this whole ongoing thing where they're splitting species into two species, one species and two species, or lumping. And it's, you know, it's a interesting like dynamic because it's, we think of species as being these very distinct categories. You know, when you learn in your biology class about species, we just talk about them as these kind of units. And we don't really talk about it all being on like an evolutionary spectrum where somebody has to draw a line somewhere and say, you know, this is now different from this. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what systematics is. I didn't do that part of the project. I did the, you know, ecological analysis.
You're out there catching bees, doing the fun stuff. Or at least in my opinion, the more fun stuff, I don't know.
Yeah, and then cataloging all the data and analyzing like differences between habitats and species composition and stuff. So
is
more
that,
like macro scale, like zoomed out, looking at kind of big picture patterns rather than, you know, the other end of that is the systematics where you're looking at a microscope all day.
Is Pinnacles where you did the studies on what bees do without flowers?
Yeah.
I love that.
Oh, thanks.
How so just, I guess, what do bees do when there's no flowers?
Well, like in this one instance, so I mentioned being a brand new grad student that was shipped off to California to, you know, figure out what's going on with the bees. And it was February when we started. And so I had a couple weeks, this was on purpose, I had a couple weeks before really anything was blooming to try to set up my plots and figure out what my protocol was going to be and kind of hone my bee catching skills, because we did catch many tens of thousands of bees by hand. And so, you know, I was out there wandering around these kind of dreary, cold landscapes where nothing is blooming, but I was still seeing bees. And so I was kind of confused as to what was going on, and found that in this particular case, the bees were actually accessing honeydew, which is a secretion by another kind of insect called a scale insect that kind of attaches to plants and sucks out the fluid from plants, processes, kind of takes the nutrients it wants, and then excretes this sugary liquid that, you know, sometimes a lot of people have heard of ants and aphids and that kind of mutualism. That's based on honeydew. Scale insects also produce honeydew. And so the bees were finding this honeydew, which I thought was fascinating for a lot of reasons, because first of all, why are the bees out before the flowers are out? Mm-hmm. And that could be a climate change thing. And then second of all, how are they finding this if our whole concept of the reason why flowers spend all of this energy producing these showy petals and colors and why wildflowers are beautiful is theoretically to attract pollinators. But if pollinators can find sugar that's not at all advertised by any of those things, then like what's going on?
That's baffled me all week, honestly. Like it's been, since I read it, what, probably last weekend, it's been living in my head.
Oh, awesome. Rent-free. It was one of those things that just started as kind of a side project. Like, I was just curious about this thing, and then it sort of took over my life for a little while doing that project.
Did you ever come to a solid hypothesis as to how they find it?
Yeah. So I think we called it, it's been a while since I read that paper, but I think we called it social eavesdropping. So
that is what you called it.
Yeah. So, and that was, kind of a new thing for that we were talking about. So I was really excited about this aspect of the paper, is that this was the first documentation of solitary bees using information from like having some kind of social interaction with other bees in their foraging pursuits. So there, you know, our hypothesis, which was based on a few different analyses, was that one bee is flying through the habitat, finds this honeydew by chance, and then its activity around that plant attracts other bees. And these are all solitary species that aren't known to interact with other bees at all. So it was really interesting. But then when you start to get a couple bees on a plant, then all of a sudden you get a lot more. So it kind of supports that idea of social eavesdropping, that you're a solitary species, but you're noticing what other insects are doing when you're out looking desperately for sugars because there's no flowers.
So an area gets a little bit of attention and that just starts to snowball on account of pheromones and smells mostly, or sight? Do you think?
I mean, we weren't able to test that, but yeah, it could be either.
I think that's just so amazing still. Didn't mold have to do something to do with that?
Yeah. So this project is kind of a fun example of just how science starts as one thing and turns into something totally different. And a lot of really cool, you know, findings were not the questions that were originally asked. So I originally called this, you know, my moldy plant study, because after these scale insects secrete the honeydew and it kind of runs onto the branches of the plant, then these were chamise plants. They were not flowering at the time. They're these big kind of like woody shrubs, and that's the plant that we were looking at that these scale insects were on. The honeydew runs onto the branches, and then it's a sugar in the habitat on the branches. So the honeydew molds, and it's black. So the first thing I noticed was, you know, I thought at first that these bees were somehow collecting this mold. And, you know, there's other insects that are known to do things like that, farm fungus and stuff. So I was like, well, that would be insane if I found, you know, native bees farming fungus. Like,
it would be so, just like, ooh,
would be really cool. So that's kind of what I thought we were looking at first. And so that's why I called it kind of the black mold study. But then it turned out we did some experiments where we like sprayed a sugar composition on that mimicked the honeydew on other plants, and then sprayed some with like a black paint to mimic the mold, but without honeydew. And so kind of having different treatments like that allowed us to tease apart what exactly was attracting the bees. And the presence of mold is not a significant driver of them like going to the plant, or it's not anything that they're collecting. So it's just the honeydew.
So although many states could use the European honeybee as their state insect, Utah might be the least apt one to do so, because we have so many really cool wild bees that are largely solitary, don't have hives, don't have nests, don't have colonies, don't have queens, and they're out there doing a whole lot of work everywhere. Many new ones to be discovered yet.
One of our most important agricultural bees in Utah is non-honeybee. It's a solitary mason bee called the blue orchard bee. And some studies have shown that two mason bees in an orchard can do the same amount of work as 100 honeybees. Yes, so back to Dr. Miners. That's kind of a nice segue into some of my questions from the bar from my shift on Sunday. So I know, like, your European honeybees do bee bread and whatnot. Do solitary local pollinators do anything like that? I mean, do they eat anything other than sort of simpler sugars?
Yeah. Did someone at the bar ask you that?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Did they actually say bee bread?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Well, that's because I taught her about that like 8 months ago, though, okay, too. Okay, she was already a little in the know.
Gotcha. I was like, wow, I'm impressed.
I just get all excited.
You know, bee bread came up in random conversation.
That was from one of
bar.
My coworkers.
Okay, cool.
A little more sober, too.
Yeah. Pretty much all species of bees, the eggs develop on some variation of bee bread, which is a combination of pollen that the female, the mother, collects, and then mixed with nectar. And so it's kind of this like cookie dough-ish consistency that's just lots and lots of trips to go collect pollen and then trips to suck up some nectar and then kind of mixing it together and patting it into this little ball. And then the female lays her egg right on top of it, usually in these underground nests. And then we'll like seal that cell, and the egg develops underground just all by itself.
That's so cute. Oh my gosh, jeez. Okay, so we're just doing kind of non sequitur rapid fire mode, ready? Do bees fight ever? And if so, can bees sting other bees? And if so, what happens?
I like that question. I actually don't know the answer, but I have seen bees be kind of territorial. When I kind of walked up to them, I've even been, this sounds weird, but I've been headbutted by a bee several times, where like you walk over to collect them or whatever, and they're like, no, this is my bush, like get out of here. And this happened to me and my technician several times. We're like, I just got headbutted by a bee. So I don't know if they sting each other or what those kind of interactions are. I don't know that anyone studied that. It would be interesting. There's a real lack of knowledge on kind of how different bees compete with each other and stuff. So that would kind of fall into that category of missing information.
I think that's so funny that just like, yeah, I'll fight you. Let's go. Bring it on.
I mean, of course, that's our interpretation of what it's doing. But, you know, that's what it seemed like it was doing.
Oh, well, that leads to my next question. Nice. Do bees kind of specific or solitary bees, do they have favorite flowers or favorite, you know, types of flowers, or are they kind of general?
Both. There's like a whole ball of yarn here that I could unwind, but I'll try to just keep it simple. There are some bees that seem to be what we call obligate specialists, where they can only raise their young on a certain type of pollen. And if you switch the pollen that was in their bee bread, then the egg doesn't develop properly. So there is some real kind of nutritional, like very kind of narrow evolutionary paths there where they're tied, those two species are tied together. And then there's a lot of generalist species where they just visit anything. They go to whatever, they're not picky, that's honeybees and kind of a lot of the more common bees. And then in the middle, you have bees that I would say have like preferences. They tend, if you look at the data on their visitation patterns, they tend to go to specific flowers, but they'll also visit others if those ones are in bloom or something.
Okay, what's a bee's morning rituals like?
Oh my gosh, I need to tell you about finding you. I mean, you've said a couple times already that you think bees are cute, but have you ever seen a bee sleeping in a flower?
No.
The cutest.
Oh no.
Next time it is like a little bit cold but still warm enough for bees, and next time it like rains a tiny bit overnight, get up early, go outside and look inside of flowers. You might have to like pull the petals apart because sometimes the petals close overnight, and you probably find bees just like all nestled up, sleeping right at the bottom of the flower. And those are male bees, because male solitary bees don't create their own nest and they don't live with the female. So the females are the only ones that build nests. So the males have nowhere to go at night. So they, a lot of the times they sleep in flowers, and it's really cute when you find them in the morning before they've woken up.
This sort of strays more into the honeybee territory, but it's the only honeybee question I'm going to ask, I think. Do you think honeybees can tell their honey from other colonies' honey? That got asked twice at the bar for some reason.
I don't think so, because sometimes you can add honey to a hive that might be struggling or like didn't is low in their provisions over the winter or something. Mm-hmm. So you can give them honey back, and I think not necessarily always from the same hive. So I think, I don't know if they can, if they know the difference, but I think they still will consume honey that didn't originate in their hive.
What are like some of the best small scale and large scale practices that we can follow to just do our best to help them in this time of like changing climate and sort of it's a struggle for them?
So planting wildflowers, especially things that are going to bloom at different times of the year so that there's kind of always something blooming and you don't have that situation where the bees are looking for honeydew sugars that are few and far between or something. Avoiding using pesticides as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, telling everybody how cool bees are so yes. that y'all care more.
Huge. What was the journey from field biologist to journalist? How was that? How was it?
A little rocky, but mostly fun. So yeah, it seems like a kind of an abrupt shift to most people, but my favorite parts of the scientific process when I was a researcher were always kind of coming up with a question, looking for what is already known about that, and figuring out how I was going to know more, and then writing up the final product and publishing it, which most people hate that part, but I kind of liked that part. And all the middle stuff that takes forever, where you're like collecting the data and analyzing it and your computer crashes 100 times, and I was like not so into that. So while I was in grad school, I started a blog and I was writing more and I was kind of getting some recognition for that, and just getting more and more interested in like how we communicate science to people, because kind of going back to why I said I got into studying bees because I wanted to be kind of part of solving real world problems. If you do a bunch of research and nobody ever hears about it, then and it doesn't make its way into policy, then you didn't solve any problems. So I kind of got interested in being like that bridge of information from science to journalism. And then in journalism, you know, you still have those pieces that I liked about science where, you know, my job now is I learn about something that's going on and I think like, that's weird. I wonder, you know, if it impacts like this, and then I go read about it, and then I call people and ask them about it, and that's kind of like the data collection phase, and then I write it up and publish it. And so I think that they're kind of parallel paths, and I get to use a lot of the same skills, but I get to learn about lots of different kinds of things in journalism, which is fun.
If people want to find your work, where's the best place to start? Where can we find you online or anywhere?
I'm on Twitter a lot. My handle is at BeeCycles. It's BEE and then cycles like a bicycle. Awesome. And I also have a website that's just www.joanmeiners. That's MEINERS.com. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my science and journalism work is up on that. So.
And then published in the Spectrum too, right?
My awesome. Current work is in there, but I've got a variety of other outlets that I've written for.
So. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
The Southern Utah Science Cafe was created by Rico Del Sesto and Aaron O'Brien and is supported by the Dennis and Diane Lyman Geosciences Center and the research office at Dixie State University. Brady Iverson is our social media intern and music maker. This episode was produced by Jeffrey Smith. Follow us on Instagram at Science Cafe Utah and check us out on the web at sciencecafe.dixie.edu. Until next time, stay curious.